Hello.
Is this Mind's Eye Radio?
Yes, it is.
This is Mother Nature. And I just heard that you wonderful folks at Mind's Eye Radio are devoting a whole hour just to little old me.
Well, we are doing a show on nature.
Exactly. And I can't wait to hear you sing my praises.
We do have an original song about family camping.
And extol my virtues.
I should warn you that one of our poets says you're too fickle to have as a friend.
What?
Oh, but we have an essay about how everyone needs to speak up on your behalf.
That's better. And only what I deserve, mind you. I wonder if I can kick up a little rainy weather so people will have to stay indoors and listen to Mind's Eye Radio.
It's Mind's Eye Radio. It's radio within reach.
I profess, both to learn and to teach anatomy, not from books, but from dissections, not from positions of philosophers, but from the fabric of nature. Welcome to The Fabric of Nature on Mind's Eye Radio. I'm your host, Greg Willard. Mind's Eye Radio is written and produced by the Mind's Eye Radio Collective in Madison, Wisconsin. The quote I just read is from 17th century physician William Harvey, who revolutionized medicine by trying to look at how nature shapes human beings rather than the other way around. In the next hour, the Mind's Eye writers look at both sides of this equation through original poetry, songs, and essays. You'll hug a tree, ride shotgun on a disastrous family vacation, discover what oatmeal and galaxies have in common, and even get a chance to play Mother Nature. All that and more, much more, on the most creative hour on radio. Come along as we explore the fabric of nature. Most people lead such busy lives these days that they lose touch with the natural world. But all of us have strong connections to the fabric of nature formed when we were very young. Close your eyes a moment and travel back to your childhood. What do you remember about your first encounter with nature?
My first remembrances of nature are probably those two great big old elms that we had in the backyard. We had a really big backyard when I was a kid, and when I was 6 or 7, I remember looking up and seeing these huge towering presences. They weren't, you know, real good for climbing. The first branches were really kind of far up, but I just kind of like to, sit under them and kind of hunt for bugs in them, around them and stuff. So, like I said, I went back there several years ago, and they'd been cut down because of the Dutch elm disease. I guess they got that, so it's pretty tragic, but I'll always remember them.
When I was 3 or 4 years old, we lived in a farmhouse set in a farmer's yard. About 20 feet from the main house, there was a well house where they brought up water from the well into a kind of stone and mortar large tub where they set the big milk cans in to cool and stay cool. And in one corner of this well house was a barrel with a bit of burlap laying over it, in which quite a lot of bees had made their nest. And I was afraid of the bees. They'd go soaring in and out of the open doorway. And I told my mother I was afraid, and she said, "Well, honey, you know, if you're just nice to them, they won't hurt you." So my idea of being nice to them was I would go and pick some wildflowers and decorate their home. And I did that. I laid my little flowers around on top of the burlap, and of course they didn't understand. So I got royally stung. And I came screaming out of the well house. And people came running from every direction, including both my parents, who pulled me over towards the trailer house and were going to go inside when they realized I still had bees underneath my clothing. So we stood there, me objecting and them pulling my clothes off in front of God and everybody. So there I was, in pain, humiliated, with my modesty in shreds.
When I was 3 or so, my sister and I got our first pet, a pair of rats. She had Mommy Rat, all white, and I had Daddy Rat, black and white. Fairly soon the rats had rat babies. My mom said, "Don't touch the babies, you'll hurt them." Well, one day I couldn't resist. I picked up a tiny pink bear-skinned baby. It was no bigger than my fingertip, with its eyes still shut. As I picked it up, its skin came right off, like a wet, bloody grape popping out. All I could think to do was to kill it to end its suffering, so I crushed its head. I was too ashamed to admit what I'd done, but stupidly buried the baby in the shavings of the cage. Well, my sister found that dead baby. Was she ever upset? She said Daddy Rat had killed it. I was still too ashamed to say anything, but I felt really awful when poor, innocent Daddy Rat was put in solitary in a separate, small cage.
Most of my early associations with nature are pretty benign. When I was a small child in Michigan, I especially remember the snow. And the two highlights of snow that I can remember are, one, my parents helping me create snow ice cream by bringing in big scoops of snow from outside and then pouring maple syrup over it. And number two, one crystal clear night in the side yard of the church, playing snow angels, lying down in the snow and just flapping our arms and creating these wonderful snow angels with the snow falling down and everything very peaceful and the people assembling for church. I really like that.
My first remembrance of nature and life in the open was lying wrapped head to toe in a scratchy wool blanket on the back seat of our old Ford with isinglass snap-in windows. We were on the way to Texas from Oregon and got caught in a sandstorm. I remember my parents had goggles and their hair wrapped in towels. It was my third birthday, and we stopped at a gas station, and I was given a cupcake with a candle in it. I forget about the candle for sure, but it was etched in my memory that my father expected me to drink my milk, which had a thin film of fine sand on it. I liked milk better without sand in it, but like children of that era, I probably did as I was told.
You can't really burn them off. You can't really pull them off. You can't tweezer them off. Leeches are forever. I'm talking African queen-style leeches.
Those were some of the Mind's Eye writers recounting early memories of nature. Some years ago, poet Fran Rawl found herself thinking about another childhood memory of nature. It began when her daughter asked her a question.
The tree hugger. 1. At the dinner table, my child said she had an English assignment. Describe a relationship you've had with a tree. What? Then I remembered the California experience with an English walnut. In my aunt's backyard, we swung from the thick white limbs, always with our best Tarzan yells. And the elderberry in our yard, too fragile for climbing, but great to play tea party under, eating the mild berries. 2. Have you hugged a tree lately? The bare giant looming over you, still strong, still forked, scragged limbs, moss-covered, like the Persephone underworld. Press your cheek against the scaly bark. It's like a totem pole, life inside waiting to emerge. Dead is relative. Green leaves are so ephemeral. Ear to trunk. You hear the roar of the elements like a child with a big seashell. If you press hard enough, you may enter into that strong-celled world. This is Fran Ross signing off for Mind's Eye Radio.
For writer Sue Renard, choosing just one childhood memory was difficult because she had so many, as she recalls in her essay, Nurtured to Love Nature.
In the 40-plus years that I've known them, my parents have never said, "This is nature, appreciate it." They have never said that wilderness can refresh the spirit. They never told me to read the works of Leopold or Muir or Thoreau. They never joined a nature group, never slapped anything like a Think Globally bumper sticker on a car. But my parents have a photograph of me when I was 2 years old. It's just after dawn in the Mammoth Caves campground in Kentucky. I'm curled up on a towel outside our family's tent. My parents had panicked when they awoke, fearing I had run off, and were relieved to find that I'd apparently just gotten too warm during the night, so had dragged my beach towel outside to sleep. Even at that age, I had no fear of the outdoors. Which might seem strange if you knew that I grew up in the heart of suburbia, surrounded by paved streets, tree-shaded bungalows, and a few churches and schools. The streetlights stayed on all night, adding an eerie glow to the sky. Not a mountain or lake or wooded park for miles around. But my dad had grown up in a small town, and my mother was a farm kid, and during my childhood, they went out of their way to make it possible for us to do the things that had come naturally in their rural paths. My dad would pitch the tent in our backyard so we could sleep outside, or bundle us up into the car late at night and drive miles out into the country so we could watch for shooting stars. My mother took us for hikes in the local park. And there were the camping trips, one every summer from as early as I can remember until I was in my teens. We went everywhere, from the lobster villages of Maine to the beaches of Georgia to the top of Pike's Peak and the hills of San Francisco. And that's how it happened that I found it natural to sleep under the stars, even when I was two. I don't have many memories from when I was that young, and perhaps it's only because I've seen the photos of our Mammoth Caves trip so many times, but I swear I remember the feeling of the cool breeze on my cheek as I lay on my towel. And I remember running down a wooded path, keeping just ahead of my mother. I remember holding my mother's hand as we walked down a stone path that led into the giant caverns, craning my neck to see a ceiling that was higher than any I'd seen before or since. I remember the feel of the damp, smooth rocks that flowed down the walls. So though my parents never preached to me about nature, I learned from their example to think of nature as an expected part of everyday life, just like telephones and cars and friends and music and grocery stores. And I'm coming to realize that in order for future generations to have that same attitude, people like me can't just sit on the sidelines anymore. So I've had to learn to talk about nature as something that I treasure, as something that deserves to be protected. I volunteer for nature groups and vote for environmental candidates. I pay extra for a nature license plate for my car. And someday soon, I may have to go get me a Think Globally bumper sticker. For Mind's Eye Radio, this is Sue Renard.
You're listening to The Fabric of Nature from Mind's Eye Radio. Coming up, hear about a family vacation gone awry, learn a lesson in the art of walking, and listen to some pond talk. Stay with us. Not all family vacations turn out well. Here's singer and songwriter Lynn Patrick Smith.
It was an ordinary Monday. My wife was feeling blue. She said, I think I've got the perfect cure for you. Let's rent an Airstream trailer. I think it's back to nature time. Sorry now that I said it, but it sounded great at the time. Let's take a family vacation. The trip will do us good. We'll go up to Wisconsin and to the great North Woods. We'll have to share our food with raccoons, fight mosquitoes the size of flies. But hey, we'll be in the great outdoors, having the time of our lives. I read the map upside down. I didn't think we'd make it there. The Kids were yelling in the back seat, pulling each other's hair. My wife hollered, "Jimmy, don't treat your sister mean. You know that if you don't behave, we won't stop at the Dairy Queen." And it's a family vacation. The trip will do us good. We'll go up to Wisconsin, to the Great North Woods. We'll have to share our food with raccoons, fight mosquitoes the size of flies. But hey, we'll be in the great outdoors, having the time of our lives. We got there, I backed up the Airstream. I heard, "Look out for that tree." You know those warnings always come just a little late for me. Taylor slipped the hitch and it started to roll away. Was headed for the lake and all I could do was pray. But it's a family vacation. The trip will do us good. We're up here in Wisconsin, out in the Great North Woods. We'll have to share our food with raccoons, fight mosquitoes the size of flies. But hey, we're in the great outdoors, having the time of our lives. The trailer was slowly sinking to the bottom of the lake. Speaking to my wife, I knew would be a mistake. I said, "We may have lost the trailer, but the kids are just fine." Then Jimmy said, "Hey, Dad, we'll have to do this again sometime." And our family vacation didn't turn out like we planned. Maybe next time we should just go to Disneyland. And we'll see Donald and Mickey, take the kids on all the rides, and try again to survive the time of our lives.
This is Lynn Patrick Smith for Mind's Eye Radio.
If your adventure into nature is to be more successful than the one we just heard about, you may need some lessons in how to enjoy the world around you. Here's some instruction on the art of walking from naturalist Henry David Thoreau. It is true, we are but faint-hearted crusaders. Our expeditions are but tours, and come round again at evening to the old hearthside from which we set out. Half the walk is but retracing our steps. We should go forth on the shortest walk, perchance, in the spirit of undying adventure, never to return, prepared to send back our embalmed hearts only as relics to our desolate kingdoms. If you are ready to leave father and mother and brother and sister and wife and child and friends and never see them again, if you have paid your debts, made your will, settled all your affairs, you are a free man. Then you are ready to walk. No wealth can buy the requisite leisure, freedom, and independence which are the capital in this profession. It comes only by the grace of God. It requires a direct dispensation from heaven to become a walker. You must be born into the family of walkers. Of course, it is of no use to direct our steps to the woods if they do not carry us thither. I am alarmed when it happens that I have walked a mile into the woods bodily without getting there in spirit. In my afternoon walk, I would fain forget all my morning occupations and my obligations to society. but it sometimes happens that I cannot easily shake off the village. The thought of some work will run in my head, and I'm not where my body is. I'm out of my senses. In my walks, I would fain return to my senses. What business have I in the woods, if I'm thinking of something out of the woods? So we saunter toward the Holy Land, till one day the sun shall shine more brightly than ever he has done, shall perchance shine into our minds and hearts, and light up our whole lives with a great awakening light, as warm and serene and golden as on a bankside in autumn. The essay, Walking, was a final testament to his lifelong search for the essential facts of life. Commissioned by the Atlantic Monthly, the essay was published months after Thoreau's death in 1862, and fittingly served as a final ode to his life in nature as he sauntered toward the Holy Land. Once you've gotten out into nature, there's no telling what you might observe and hear. Poet Jackie Wilson describes two of her favorite natural wonders.
Mushrooms. Mushrooms are nature's surprise gift in the package of a day. Pond talk. Reeds admire their necklaces of clustered sunlight in the wavering water mirror, as they gossip in the borrowed voices of the rustling breeze. This is Jackie Wilson for Mind's Eye Radio.
Poet Sharon Van Sluice.
This poem shows how spring comes to the urban places covered in concrete and asphalt, but it comes nonetheless. Spring comes to the city. One March night, the wind shifts southerly, and throughout the next morning, the sun means it. Within hours, all the gray snow changes phase. Bubbles seep up through cracks in the sidewalk as though mystery fish were waking, beginning to breathe. Downtown, grimy taxis and buses plunge through submerged avenues, splashing hugely, graceless swimmers they practice all day. On the wet walk, carefully dressed women pick their way feline in their precious and dangerous shoes. Inside boxes of shop window glass, bevies of tall plastic beauties in gauzy print dresses are holding their exquisite wrists in mid-flex and tilting their narrow hips into spring.
That was Madison poet Sharon Van Sluice.
Thank you.
For decades, we've been debating the question of whether nature or nurture plays a stronger role in shaping who we are. Poet Paul Thompson is still thinking about it.
Nature versus nurture. Those celebrated twins tear each other's hair, but neither sister wins. Did DNA drive Cain to bop his only brother? Or can education schemes make us love each other? Why do Asian students cream the SAT? Is it cultural pressure or biodestiny? Are men really Mars? Are women really Venus? Is aggressiveness located in the penis? Do gays have different brains? Or does family dysfunction explain their preferences in amorous conjunction? Don't look for answers here. Onward the battle rages, and will doubtless entertain those of succeeding ages. Nature versus nurture. Neither sib can rout the other, try as she might, and compromise is out. For nature's way of thinking, her very genes enforce, while early socialization set nurture on her course. This is Paul Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
If you had the chance to create the world to be all-powerful, would you take it? Poet Evie Thompson did, at least in a dream.
The Role of Nature. In a dream, I am allowed to play the role of nature. A white sheet of paper, wetted down for finger painting, is spread before me. I am delighted. With globs of paint, I begin creating a world. But then, something is amiss. Something not quite right. I start over, smearing the paint with the side of my hand to make a flat, blank surface. Now, what is this? Unbidden, tiny humans rise from the paint, shaking their fists in anger and sorrow over their lost homes and loved ones. This is Evie Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
It's been said that progress is not an accident, but a necessity. It's part of nature. And in recent decades, that progress has allowed humans to reweave the very fabric of nature. Kelly Warren spoke with a lesbian couple in Madison who chose alternative insemination, or AI, to have a child. Through a sperm bank, Barbara and Jill selected an anonymous donor from a list of about 50 men. And after several attempts, the couple are now the moms of Nathaniel, who's 17 months old.
Mommy. This started a way long time ago.
Mommy.
With wanting to have kids and not being in a relationship with a man. Then thinking that possibly
Mommy.
We could find a guy who would be interested in being some form of a father. But that's pretty complicated. We actually interviewed a number of guys who were interested. But the more we talked about it, they either talked themselves out of it or talked us out of using them because we wanted to definitely be the major parents.
There are a number of sperm banks. We specifically wanted to choose a bank that had something called an identity release donor so that when what that means is when the child reaches the age of 18, the donor has agreed to allow identifying information about them to be released to the child so the child can find the donor if they choose to. And the donor agrees to, you know, keep the sperm bank aware of their address and things. That was really important to us. We wanted to give him a chance to find out more about where he came from. And there's not a lot of those in the country.
This one was located where?
In Berkeley.
So what were you looking for? What were the things on this list that you were looking for?
What happens is you get this sort of list, and it's got you know, the, I'd say maybe 50 choices on it. And then you could call and say, now, of these 50 choices that just have that really basic information, we'd like to get an information sheet on, and you could pick as many as you want. And the information sheet is a two-sided piece that has a little bit more information about them. It has a short medical history, including family medical history. The donor makes a statement about why they are choosing to donate sperm. The donor, if it's a yes donor, talks about why they chose to be a yes donor. You get to hear about hobbies and interests, education, profession, religion, if they're religious. And then from there, when we would call, we would choose. Usually we'd wind up having three choices because you'd call and they might say your first choice isn't available this month. And I think what we looked for seemed like it was always something different. We tried really hard when I was trying to get pregnant to have someone who had some nationality background that Barbara had. Barbara's father was Jewish and that was really important to her. But that was really, really hard. And we actually wound up, I think, only once being able to have a donor that had any similar nationality background. Some of it was feeling, I think. We'd read the statements that they made.
The question would be, why did you donate sperm? And the answer could range from, I needed the money, to, I have a really high intellect and I needed to pass that on to the rest of humanity, which got X off our list quickly. One of them was my sister and her partner had a baby through AI, and it was really a beautiful thing. I love the fact that this kid is here, and I'd like to help some other people do that.
And unfortunately, that was always like our first choice was that donor, and we never got him because I'm sure everybody else felt the same, like, heartstrings, isn't that the sweetest thing? So we never got him. We also were looking for someone who was musical because of Barbara's musical background. So, little mouse, yeah. When I was trying to get pregnant, it took me actually 10 cycles, and we wound up, we'd pick a donor, and then the next time I wouldn't be pregnant, we'd go back the next month, and that donor doesn't have any more sperm left, or they've had too many children born from them, so they stop using that donor, and so we'd wind up having to then go through the process of picking somebody else. The thing that we thought was particularly enjoyable about the donor we chose was that they asked what your hobbies and interests are, and he was maybe like 23 or 24 or something, and his hobby and one of his hobbies was, I have been folding origami for over 20 years. We thought that was the cutest thing in the world. So
every time he starts to fold a piece of paper, we rush over.
Oh, that's the origami gene. And the other thing about the donor we chose is that he's a mathematician, and neither of us have any particularly strong math skills, and thought, well, if there's any sort of genetic qualities or anything, that might be a good one to pass on to him since he won't get anyplace else. So it's kind of like shopping in a way. I mean, you get to just kind of pick different things and...
Yeah, but there are no rain checks. If you get there and there's nothing left, then you just have to go down your list. We'd been given the name of a clinic and a doctor that was fine about helping women with infertility problems, and he saw this as an infertility problem. So that's really what he told us. And so we just went to that clinic here, and they have a storage tank, a nitrogen storage tank for the sperm, because it comes frozen. It gets shipped out in vials, in dry ice or a nitrogen tank.
You used a whole syringe at one time?
Oh. A whole syringe is a huge exaggeration. It's 0.5 cc's is a vial of the thing to remember is it's not semen. It's just sperm. They spin it down. I usually inseminated twice in a cycle. We wound up trying a whole bunch of different ways with me. We did a couple where we did it with the doctor in the office, a couple times with the nurse, a couple times where we actually went to the doctor's office. They gave us a room, and they gave us the sperm right out of the nitrogen tank and then let us have the room, and Barbara inseminated me. We tried a couple times where we did it at home. And the month that I got pregnant with Nathaniel, it was a Saturday and a Sunday, and the Saturday night we did it at home, and Sunday morning we went to the clinic, and a physician's assistant inseminated me at the clinic. The shipping actually costs a fair amount of money. So if you are expecting that you're going to need more than 1 month's worth, in some ways it's more cost effective to buy a couple extra vials. And then if you have, especially if you have a place to store it, in our case, we had a free place to store it for as long as we needed to, because it is really, really expensive. I mean, it cost, we estimated that it usually cost us about $500 a month.
Wow. Now you mentioned that when he's 18, mm-hmm. that he has the option of going back to this sperm bank mm-hmm. and basically going right to the file, right?
Yeah.
Going right to the records. And so yeah. it's not like this big search process. Right. He can go right. right to it if he wants.
I believe that he gets the name of the donor and any known address or information. I mean, a donor who chooses to be an identity release donor is making a very different decision, in my opinion, than the donors who don't do that because they are taking the chance of having some kid at 18 knock on their door and say hi. It just seemed like there wasn't a risk when a child is 18. You don't have to worry about custody or child support or things like that.
You're going to leave it up to Nathaniel to whether or not he wants to seek out the donor.
Mm-hmm. We could not access the information. It's only the child has the right to access the identifying information. We haven't talked about this a whole lot, so maybe I'm saying something that we don't both agree with, but what information we have, we will share with him. And I mean, the way that we've talked about explaining it is that, you know, it was just a really nice man who knew that we really wanted to have a baby and we needed help to do it. And that's how he got here, and this is what we know about him. And as a way of sort of hopefully, I don't know, normalizing it as much as possible.
How does he address you, or how does he relate to the two of you?
Well, the word mommy means I want. It doesn't mean any particular person. It just means give me that thing. So he says mommy a lot, but he says it to the dog. He says it to, so mommy hasn't crept in yet.
But, mommy.
Yeah, we'll try to get him to call us various things, and he'll probably come up with his own.
Right now we refer to ourselves as Mama Jill and Mama Baba. Everybody knows how heterosexuals get pregnant. So it's not even a question. That's why people don't ask what room was it in, because it's sort of irrelevant. That's what we sort of hope will be the case with AI, is that, or with, you know, lesbian families or whatever. So I answer. I mean, I feel pretty comfortable saying this is what we did, this is the process. But I think we're going to have to confront some of that, especially as he gets older and goes to school and there are, you know, friends and things like that, that those questions are going to be asked, and we have to feel comfortable answering them mm-hmm. and for him to feel comfortable about that's where he came from.
I think we both think it's really important to have good male role models for any kid, being a boy or a girl. And we definitely are sifting through our friends saying, okay, this guy is going to teach him how to pee, and this guy is going to teach him how to be, you know, a basketball player who's gentle, you know, or whatever. I mean, although I could do that, I suppose. And so it's not that we don't want him to have men in his life. We definitely do. And they'll bring gifts that we can't give him.
And, you know, making sure that he is proud of who he is, and also not forcing him to be something just because that's how the world defines what a boy is or a girl is.
You're listening to The Fabric of Nature on Mind's Eye Radio, the most creative hour on the airwaves. I'm Greg Willard. Coming up, we pick blackberries, explore the similarities between oatmeal and galaxies, see why nature wouldn't make a good friend, and hear how the media plays fast and loose with nature's rules. Stay with us. Madison poet Esther Cameron.
The Blackberry Picker. Where blackberries with brighter dark articulate the leaf-layered shade, hand reaching in among the sharp thorns relearns its ancient trade. Surely for this the swiveling wrist, the supple finger joints were made. And as they pluck, the smooth palm's cup makes and remakes itself to hold the loosened berries as they drop, the prudent seconding the bold. From such cabal of skill and skill, the rest might well have been foretold. Who would have heard what no one said? Here no one thinks aloud but I. The birds are gone, amid the dead leaves of the floor, a cricket's cry. An airplane somewhere overhead furrows the wind's unending sigh. This hand, once having gashed the ground to feed where earth could nurse no more, found itself quick to many an end, and learnt to learn and write its lore. Yet never found a work that wore so smoothly as this first, uncursed. It wishes, earth, that it could close the wound it struck so heedlessly, and at your dole with all that grows take dearth and bounty, live and die, since the fulfillment of its will proved sharper than necessity. This is Esther Cameron for Mind's Eye Radio.
In 1841, Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote, "Everything in nature contains all the powers of nature. Everything is made of one hidden stuff." Well, today we know that everything is created from the same molecules and subatomic particles, but the true fabric of nature may have even larger patterns that hold true. Scientist Elena Tabachnik has a secret that just may prove Emerson was more right than even he knew.
Since 1988, I have had a lovely secret. Now I want to share it with you. The biological species definition is supposed to apply to all living things. According to this theory, organisms within a species vary continuously, like height among humans. But an absolute and unbridgeable gap exists between species. For my doctorate in evolutionary theory, I studied some critters called planktonic forams. These are like amoeba, but with shells. The planktonic forams did not come in species. Oh, they varied a lot. One foram might look as different from another as a monkey from a human. So they ought to have had many species. But the expected gaps weren't there. Well, I was hardly the first person to notice this. But most people figured the best they could do was to assume the critters came in species, sort the ones that could be identified, work with those, and ignore the rest. But I'm interested in organization. If forams didn't come in species, I wanted to know how they were organized. Imagine each standard species as a pea. Each pea is completely separate from other peas. But the organisms I studied weren't like peas. I figured there were two other possible patterns. One is uniform, like tomato soup. Another is continuous, but with concentrations, like lumpy oatmeal. When I analyzed my samples, I got shocking results. Although certainly not peas, my organisms weren't tomato soup or lumpy oatmeal. They were something totally different. Twisting lumpy threads between empty spaces. I was stumped. Not a single food metaphor applied. Then one morning, Fred Bookstein, the statistician I worked with, showed me an article from the Daily Paper. Astronomers at the Smithsonian Observatory had found that matter in the universe came in an odd pattern. The newspaper had a picture. Their pattern looked just like mine. This was the metaphor I needed. I called my pattern braided. So here is the lovely secret. The diversity of life may be distributed in the same braided pattern as matter in the universe. But let me explain why this is a secret. I never published most of my results. Oh, I gave a few talks at conferences, and maybe four people got excited about the braided pattern of planktonic forams. If we were alone and informal, I might mention the astounding similarity between forams and matter in the universe. But such ideas are pretty outre for science, so I didn't talk about it much. Well, times were tough and research jobs impossible to find, and I hated the social norms of competitive science. So after a few years, I gave up science for art. That was in 1990. Anyone who once heard this idea has long since forgotten. Even Fred, although he found that newspaper article, has doubtless forgotten. Sometimes I think about it, especially on long drives. It is such an entertaining idea. Just think, maybe the diversity of life has the same pattern as all matter in the universe. This is Elena Tabachnik for Mind's Eye Radio.
There's a famous poem by Lord Byron that includes the line, "I love not man the less, but nature more." Many people find that they love nature, but like poet Evie Thompson, don't necessarily want her as a friend.
A difficult friendship. I don't think I would want to be nature's friend. Too changeable, too destructive. On the one hand, early dawn with lacework of trees silhouetted against the pale pink and blue sky. On the other hand, families huddled in treetops above the floodwaters in Mozambique. On the one hand, the sweet scent of wild plum blossoms. On the other hand, slow destruction of brain cells, Alzheimer's. And what is nature's relationship to God? Naughty brat or handmaiden, bringing chances for courage and unselfed love? This is Evie Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
We've seen all the movies where elephants fly and animals talk in English, the TV shows that glorify the power of tornadoes and hurricanes. But where is all this anthropomorphism and media manipulation of nature leading us? It's a question that haunts Norma Gay Pruitt.
When I hear nature pronounced with a capital N, I become afraid. The damage done to that word is not news. Ever since Wordsworth and that gang of romantic poets began to project all of their best fancies onto the daffodils and rainstorms, nature, with a capital N, has been represented to English and American cultures as a precious little lisping concept. From Bambi to Stuart Little, we have anthropomorphized freely, to the point that we can't really see any other aspect of our surroundings except in relation to ourselves. I guess the problem is even older than the Romantic poets. Really, since we Judeo-Christians were given, quote, dominion over all the earth, end quote, and God kicked the legs out from under the serpent, we have felt like the cutesy pie nature was the only nature worth saving. Remember Marlon Perkins and his lackey, Jim Fowler, with the real live boa wrapped around Fowler's neck? They always segued from nature to their sponsor, Mutual of Omaha, with some clever little pathetic fallacy like, this big old snake wrapped around my neck feels secure in his muscular body, but do you feel secure in your life? He doesn't need life insurance. He's got fangs. But do you have fangs? No, you don't. So Mutual of Omaha and yada, 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 yada. Even when nature is not made to serve our twisted psychological needs, as in the type of shockumentaries represented by Fox's scariest, bloodiest, clawingest, bitingest animals ever, the real world is misrepresented by splicing and editing. I read an article in Harper's Magazine a couple of years back that discussed the distortions involved in making these so-called nature shows. The author pointed out something that I had noticed, too. According to these videos, none of these animals ever sleep or just hang around scratching their fannies on baobab trees. That's because they are too busy wreaking mayhem and destruction on each other and occasionally us humans. I've noticed that some of the newer ones also make sure to include a few minutes of lovemaking, at which point Marlon Perkins would have cut quickly to a Mutual of Omaha clip. Can't you just hear the segue? Well, these ibex seem to be interested in only one thing, but you have the ability to think higher thoughts, like, do I have enough life insurance in case one of these gargantuan behemoths Marlon has been toting around should break into my apartment? But Marlon wasn't the worst of his ilk, either. At least the animals weren't made to talk English. Why would a giant panda like the ones in our modern kids' movies be speaking English? They don't even live in North America or Europe. And Disney? Don't even talk about Walt Disney. But his movies are the 500-pound gorillas, pun intended, of the entertainment business. The animals of color in his version of The Jungle Book are villainous. The apes have African-American accents. The Siamese cats in Lady and the Tramp sang in a fakey Asian illiterate patois. Remember? Where there be baby, there be milk nearby. Now, I've only had a couple of classes in linguistics, and maybe there be being a lot of Asians who don't get the principle of verb phrases, but I have to think that Disney's writers just didn't poke their heads out of the studio much. If they had, they'd have been seeing many real live Asian persons whom they could, ape. Using real animals and superimposing human emotions is not much better. Homeward Bound is a good example of this strangeness. This film lets us hear the thoughts and speech of two brave dogs and a super femme cat who get displaced and have to bravely battle their way home. I have to admit that as a mother, I would gladly plunk my son down in front of this beautifully made movie if the only other choice were Killer Bots or even Hulk Hogan. But I was still made uneasy by all the projection, and there's quite a large dollop of sexism here, too. The only obviously female character, the cat, is so helpless and stupid, one is kind of depressed when she comes back to life. Oh, all right, I cried, but just the same. I just wonder what will happen to my fancy theories, though, when the current, actually pretty old, studies on animals and language ripen. Already, as everybody knows, monkeys can be taught to sign and teach other animals to sign. Though they usually only say stuff like, who cut the cheese? And, I've been meaning to talk to you for years, but couldn't find the right fingers. Now, get out of my cage. Today, scientists who like a lot of talking, sponging up the available air, are trying to get other animals besides chimps and parrots to use human languages. My advice is, think it through, guys and gals. Now, imagine all those cute little fuzzy things with cellular phones and email capacity. Imagine how stupid those forwarded messages could be. Probably not that much worse than my Uncle Clem's, but still. This is Norma Gay Pruitt for Mind's Eye Mutual of Madison, reminding you that while this chinchilla I'm holding can't say so yet, when he does get the power of speech, he's going to tell you how much he would like one of our agents to visit to discuss insurance on his coat.
You've been listening to The Fabric of Nature, written by the Mind's Eye Radio Collective in Madison, Wisconsin. The show was produced by Kelly Warren and co-produced by Sue Renard. Contributing writers include Esther Cameron, Norma Gay Pruitt, Fran Rahl, Sue Renard, Sharon Van Sluis, Lynn Patrick Smith, Paul Thompson, Evie Thompson, Kelly Warren, and Jackie Wilson. Our theme music was produced by Barbara Chusid. If you'd like a copy of this show, or would like more information about Mind's Eye Radio, call 608-256-6525 or catch our website at www.mindseyeaudio.com. That's Mind's Eye Audio, all one word, .com. For Mind's Eye Radio, I'm Greg Willard. If the sight of the blue skies fills you with joy, if a blade of grass springing up in the fields has power to move you, if the simple things of nature have a message that you understand, rejoice, for your soul is alive.